Rap Technique. Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's the Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Hey, Jeremy's out, but B-Mac and I are still in as we take you all the way to the
Our beloved Cougs
at 6 p.m. Who the Cougs play tonight, by the way? I didn't even...
I actually don't know. I can look it up.
I don't know after that tough loss this weekend to the Texas Tech. But hopefully they bounce back tonight, get another W. Jeremy and I were talking about it, which was really kind of crazy, was the fact that they actually did not lose ground and gained ground in different polls after
Oklahoma State.
To Texas Tech. Oh, Oklahoma.
Yeah, they're only 11-10, so hopefully, fingers crossed, should be a Cougs win, yeah.
Yes, let's get the bounce back game for the Cougs tonight. Hey, before we get into more conversation, and we are going to get to some Astros conversation, if you're a fisherman, if you love going fishing, you've got to get to the 50th annual fishing show, February the 12th through the 16th at the GRB, George R. Brown Convention Center. Everything for the fisherman, all the new rods, reels, and lures, factory reps, guides from Alaska to South America, dozens of fully rigged boats, and hundreds of kayaks. Plus, continuous clinics by expert fishermen. They cover salt and freshwater fishing. And a kids' clinic on Saturday and Sunday for the kiddos to get involved in the sport. There's a giveaway also that goes with that. Kids have a chance to win. If you love to fish, just want to learn about fishing, don't miss the 50th annual fishing show. You can check it out at HoustonFishingShow.com. But if you really want to go, you got a chance to go for free because we love you guys. We're giving away a pair of tickets right now. Let's go caller number 7. Caller number 7 at 713-780-3776. If you feel lucky, go caller number 7, 713-780-3776. Skylar, our intern, we're kind of giving her a little initiation here. She's got to handle a calling, and we got to get it more than 5. She's going to be great. You're going to win, and if you win, you're going to have a great time. If you don't win them and you still want to go, HoustonFishingShow.com. All right, Brian, we got a lot of Astros talk in today, as well as all the other talk and the great talk we had about the toughest losses that you've had to stomach in Houston history. But we've been talking a lot about the fact that the Astros, we've heard they're not done. We heard Dana Brown's comments today about Bregman basically talking about him in the past tense. But has enough attention been paid to the fact that this roster is still kind of in works? They're still working some stuff out. And I think you personally have maybe a area of concern that isn't being paid enough attention to if you're the Astros.
Yeah, I feel like when you look at one of the maybe not undersung, because we all talked about how strong it was during the World Series run in 2022, but it's just kind of slowly whittled away over the last couple of years. And obviously you could say whatever you want about Ryan Pressly last year, but with the trade of him to the Cubs, it's been taken away from even a little bit more. But I'm starting to get a little concerned about the strength of the Astros bullpen after your top two hammers. I mean, no concerns about Josh Hader or Brian Abreu other than workload, especially with Abreu, because last season they overtaxed him and his performance fell off a little bit during the summer months. But I just start to worry about, okay, Hader, Brian Abreu are great as your eighth inning guy and your closer. I think I like Tyler Scott still, or you know, as your seventh inning setup guy in replacement of Ryan Pressly. He certainly had a great year out of nowhere last year, but like who's after that? I mean, Caleb Ort was a nice surprise last year. Brian King was awesome, but both those guys threw under 30 innings, so I don't think we really know exactly what you're going to get for them. And then after that, I mean, who's around? I mean, is it Sean Dubin? Is it Rafael Montero coming back up through the system?
Please don't Dubin me in January. February. Don't give me a Dubin mention.
I know, but it's just like you're looking at who else is on the roster.
I'm going to give you a name that you're probably not going to like.
Forrest Whitley?
Yes.
That kind of makes my point, doesn't it? I mean, Forrest Whitley, you know he's got great stuff. That was once upon a time had him as a like top five prospect overall when he was still a starter. But can you depend on him? He's always hurt. His ERA's been up and down. Maybe he's a one-inning guy. He's a revelation, but
I think that's what they were grooming him for last year in Sugarland when they continued to try and get him one-inning stints, you know, just empty the tank, be a kind of guy that maybe if you're setting him up for an even bigger role later in his career, at least you've taken him from the starter role to a role that he could actually make the major league roster and you could actually benefit from him for all the time we've all spent waiting trying to see him in a major league uniform. Now with Presley being eliminated from the equation, it is an interesting proposition that they have. I know that Jeremy was talking yesterday that the kid that they acquired, the local kid they acquired in the Cubs trade, might get a look.
Wisniewski?
Yeah, Wisniewski. I'm not sure he's going to make the opening day
roster. Probably going to be in the starting rotation until some of your guys are ready to go.
Yeah, I don't see him as a guy that makes the roster. You got so many starting pitchers. As good as Scott was all first half of the year last year, maybe it was that he just had too many innings and got overused, but he was a liability more than he was an asset late in the season to me. I just couldn't trust him anymore to where that would concern me. And you're right. It's an area I don't think Neris is coming back.
I wouldn't think so, no.
Yeah, I just think that that's something that they do have to take a long, hard look at to try and figure out, like, we at least had above-average guys 7, 8, 9. You've got 8 and 9 still there, but I don't know who is the leader in the clubhouse right now for the seventh inning.
Especially as you talk about bringing some of these guys back. Let's say everything falls into place for Luis Garcia and Lance McCullers, and they actually make a return. Now, you could say, okay, well, that moves someone to the bullpen, maybe like Ronel Blanco, so maybe that's how your bullpen gets a little bit better. But these guys, when you bring back Luis Garcia and Lance McCullers in a perfect world, you're not asking them to go more than 5 on a regular basis. You're going to have to bridge a gap between how long they last in their starts until you get to Abreu and Hader. And again, Taylor Scott's got to be the guy you feel best about amongst the non-Abreu, non-Hader group. But even him, like you said, maybe a little bit of a falter down the stretch. Caleb Orton, Brian King were good for a little bit of time last season, but we're talking about sample sizes that were under 30 innings for those two guys. So I don't know. I mean, this could be a thing where Brian King and Caleb Orton and Taylor Scott all continue to pitch well, and then this is a complete nothing burger. But from what was once like maybe the strength of the team, it feels far more questionable than it has in a long time.
Brian, you know what? If I was to say, and Oscar on the YouTube chat says all arrows point to Whitley, I don't think so. I think that if I was to say the guy that might have the inside track, might be Ort, because he's another guy that can top out at triple digits. Mm-hmm. He can absolutely overpower three guys, regardless of where they are in the lineup. He has the stuff, at least the fastball, to be able to do that. And in spurts last year, he was pretty damn good to where I could see that they could give him first crack at it. And then if he doesn't do it, there are other guys. Scott has the ability to go multiple innings, that he's kind of like that guy that can be your kind of couple inning guy, sure, middle of the game guy, pick up for a starter that doesn't have it guy. And that versatility there is more important than trying to make him a one inning guy in the seventh and use him two out of three games in a series.
Yeah, and Brian King is a lefty, so you're probably not wanting to pigeonhole him into just being a seventh inning guy. So if he's great, I can't see him being locked into the seventh inning role either. So I think Forrest Whitley's certainly going to get, you know, a look at it. I think I've seen some roster projections that have him making the team. It's just a complete unknown because I think he threw, what, 2/3 of an inning last year in that one appearance with the big club, and that's been the entirety of his major league career. But otherwise, he's been suspended or hurt or in the minor leagues. So it's just, I feel far more uncomfortable with their bullpen. Again, 8 and 9 is great. No questions about Brian Abreu and Josh Hader. But it feels like, you know, in the post-Presley world, assuming Neris doesn't come back, all these guys that have kind of, you know, Phil Maton's no longer here, Ryan Stanek's no longer here, although he was up and down as well. It feels like there's far more questions with this bullpen than there's been in a long time.
Yeah, I think that, look, I still think they have quality arms that can get outs on a major league level. I just think that even before you got rid of Presley, I think that there was an open competition for everything other than Abreu and Hader. I think that because they rotated so many guys, and we mentioned Neris had a shot at it last year. Ort was a guy they were using a lot. You mentioned Brian King, and I think Brian King is going to have a role on this team. I think King showed enough that he gets guys out that he can be valuable in spot duty for the back of this bullpen. But I don't think it's like as solidified as it's been in the past to say you got three guys in the back of your bullpen that are just lights out. And obviously, Presley wasn't lights out. My personal opinion is that Ort's going to get first crack at it. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I could see it being Ort because, as you mentioned, I think Taylor Scott is, especially for some of your starters who are either young like Arrigetti or coming back from injury when hopefully, knock on wood, Lance McCullers or Luis Garcia come back from injury, Taylor Scott's probably going to be your not fireman, but, you know, maybe they get into the fifth inning and they need trouble because they got two on with two out and Taylor Scott comes in, finishes the inning, and then throws your sixth inning. I think he's that sort of guy for them. And then Brian King's your situational lefty. So I could see, especially until they feel comfortable, that Forrest Whitley is actually capable of a bump in his quality of play. I mean, again, two-thirds of an inning for his major league career. I could see Caleb Ort, you know, getting the shot because of that gas he throws. I mean, triple digits, at least sits 98 in, from what I remember. But, I mean, obviously the question with him and the, kind of the reason for this segment is he was a journeyman until he got to the Astros. He wasn't a long-established guy who had, you know, produced for several different teams. So it feels like even the guy that we're most comfortable with throwing in there, Caleb Ort, I mean, he's a journeyman. He was a journeyman for a reason.
Let's take the standard bullpen that we know and are most familiar with out, because to your scenario of if McCullers comes back, if Garcia comes back, I don't expect Javier, they just said today, until August.
Probably not.
So he's out of I'll leave him out of this question. Could you see a starter that is currently listed as a starter with this team becoming the seventh inning guy?
So, in that situation, the guys that are probably moving into the bullpen that are currently in the starting rotation, at least based upon the projections I've seen, would be Ronel Blanco and Hayden Wesneski, the guy that you got from the Cubs. I can't see Blanco being a seventh inning guy. I he doesn't profile as that to me. To me, he'd be more kind of what we're talking about with Taylor Scott, where he's your guy that, you know, comes in right after the starter maybe needs gets into trouble in the fifth. Maybe he's a long inning guy if someone gets rocked early and has to leave. I don't know. I guess of the two, I'd probably said Wesneski would have your best possible chance of becoming the seventh inning guy, but I still think I'd rather give the first shot to Caleb Ort.
Okay.
Just because of the gas.
Okay. I mean, if I had to try and pull one guy that I thought might be that guy, no one comes to mind that says, because in my mind, that guy's a guy that can throw upper 90s, a guy that can dominate in a short period of time. So I don't think, and I don't want McCullers in the bullpen. I know a lot of people thought about
that.
I don't want that. That's the last thing I want.
Elbow, forearm, everything.
Keith wants to get in here. I'm sure Keith is going to suggest someone that we would never have heard of possibly, but Keith, what's up?
Hey guys, you guys are talking about Astros need a seventh inning guy. Perfect guy was just DFA last week from the Dodgers, who are absolutely loaded. Ryan Brazier, former Red Sox Dodger, sub 2 ERA last year. He started playoff games. He's got a ton of appearances, a ton of experience. That's the perfect guy to pitch the seventh inning.
It's not a bad suggestion. My first question would be, at what price? Like, I know that the Dodgers dropped it. Dodgers have such a surplus of riches that I'm sure he's not going to be the only one that they don't have room for, because all the guys that they've signed. I mean, Kirby Yates was the last one, right? And he was the Rangers closer, and they got Scott. They got all these guys they're adding. If you'd have said Joe Kelly, I'd have told you to hang up on him immediately, because I thought that's where Keith was leaning.
I wouldn't sign Joe Kelly for anything.
Yeah, no. You know what? Again, what it comes down to now is Dana Brown's wallet, you know, along with, you know, the ultimate whose wallet is it in Jim Crane. I don't know, aside from, like, maybe you get him on a minor league deal with an invite to spring training and he's okay with that. I got to believe that other teams that do have more cap room are going to go after him before the Astros have a crack.
Yeah, I was pulling up his stats. I mean, last year he's definitely been pretty good. The last couple of seasons with the Dodgers, 3.54 ERA last year over 28 innings. The season before, 38 innings and a sub 1 ERA. So he's had a really good run with the Dodgers. Before that, it was kind of hit or miss. So, I mean, I sometimes wonder about, and the Dodgers have had a track record of doing this, pulling guys into their system and really turning them into upper level pitchers. I remember the starter Tyler Anderson was that way for them. He came out of nowhere. They've turned around a number of guys. So I sometimes wonder, Although the guys that have left the Astros, because the Astros have that reputation as well, have actually done quite well outside of Houston. But I do wonder sometimes about pulling in, you know, a journeyman reliever like him. He's 36 years old, really only had dominant success with the Dodgers. Does he have that same success here? So I certainly wouldn't be willing to pay top dollar for it. But if he's cheap, I think it can't hurt to take a look.
Yeah, I think maybe in a nutshell, you're trying to find the next Taylor Scott, where you just find a guy like you just mentioned that maybe for 1 year can bridge a gap and be a guy that kind of finds it, and then you work it out after that. Because I don't know who that guy is. I know that they do have a good eye for judging that kind of talent, but there's got to be some other guys that you can audition for roles in your bullpen without breaking the bank. Because I believe that if you believe what Bagwell says and there's one more move left to be made, I got to believe it's a bat in the outfield, and that's it.
Yeah, that's kind of the puzzle they have gotten themselves into because of Jim Crane kind of holding into this fake salary cap. I mean, obviously no salary cap in baseball, but the way Jim Crane operates with his, I wouldn't say fear of going over the collective bargaining tax. He certainly is, he's certainly unwilling to do it unless they make a big splash. And I think Brazier, as Keith mentioned, would be a quality addition to the bullpen. I would trust him more than some of the other names we brought up. But if you're talking about adding an outfielder and adding a reliever, that's probably putting them over the collective balance tax. I don't know if I could see Crane doing that for moves that certainly wouldn't be splashy.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, well, if you guys have thoughts, 713-780-3776, 713-780-ESPN, and we can get your thoughts out here with ours, and we can mesh it until the hour of 6 p.m. because soccer matters tonight, Brian. I know you know this, and I know that Glenn Davis is a key part of our rotation, regardless of whether he's in the bullpen or not. And sometimes he is, and sometimes he's remote, but he's going to be with
he's
soccer
here today.
Matters. At 6 o'clock. Is he here today?
Yeah, he's going to have Dynamo GM Pat Onstad on with him. So, big one tonight.
Always a good time to hear Glenn on the radio talking the ultimate football talk that he brings to the table.
Was that a Russian accent that you were doing there?
No, but he does the football.
I know. Oh, the bowl part of it kind of sounded Russian there.
I can see that. Okay, I'll give you that. All right, so with that being said, Brian, we talked a lot about relief pitchers. We talked a lot about starters that could be in the bullpen role. That means that we have to kind of determine who our Astros opening day rotation is. We'll give you ours. Maybe you want to give us yours, 713-780-3776. Give us a call. Give us a text. Reach out to us, and we'll discuss it next. It is the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 FM.
ESPN 97.5. Live in the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's the Killer Bees. Now back to Joel and Jeremy.
All right, let's have a little more play along with the Bees type interaction as we kind of switch gears from the bullpen to Astros starting pitching. Because there is multiple questions out there in terms of who's going to be healthy, who's going to be ready, who do you feel the best about. I think this is really who's going to be their fifth starter. In my mind.
I would agree. The first four feel pretty locked in. It's really the big question is who's healthy, who's number five.
So I think just for those of you living under a rock or who forgot about Astros starting pitchers, I think Fromber's number. I think it could be Fromber or Hunter Brown, but I think because
Fromber's
going to get the nod from the experience and with his situation.
He's the veteran. He's going to get the nod.
Yeah, Fromber one, Hunter Brown two. I think Blanco is three.
See, I flip-flopped. I'm assuming then would have Arrigetti number four.
Correct.
I flip-flopped them. I see the case for Blanco, but I'm high on Arrigetti's stuff. I know he's the younger guy. Blanco's in his 30s. Maybe you give the veteran the spot, but I don't know. I think I go higher upside, and ultimately, obviously, it doesn't really matter once you get into the season. It's all going to flip around anyway. But I would go with Arrigetti at number three, but not a huge. I'm not going to break my heart if they flip-flop that.
I think because it's such a big glaring question mark, to me personally, everything at number five becomes who's going to be healed from injury that's in the mix, because I think you're going to look at Garcia. who just never got back.
I don't think he's going to be ready.
And again, they're saying he's not going to be ready. McCullers, they're already saying, won't be ready, no matter how much he's throwing 89 hard miles an hour with a 73-mile-an-hour breaking ball that we all have to
Hooray.
See. Yeah, I just don't see how that factors in. I don't think that Mr. Real World is going to be ready come opening
day. Oh, J.P. France?
Yeah, J.P. France.
No, he's not going to be ready. I know you – look, I know you don't think he's going to make the roster – but because of what you just laid out, I mean, he's kind of last man standing. I think it's going to be Hayden Wesneski, the guy that got in the Kyle Tucker trade. I mean, it shouldn't be in a perfect world. I mean, I'd rather throw – I mean, I know J.P. France has really struggled from that 8-game stretch he had a couple years ago, but I'd rather have France. I'd obviously much rather have McCullers or Luis Garcia if they were healthy. I'd rather have Javier, but he's obviously way out in the future in August, best case. I think Wesneski is the last guy standing. Now, hopefully –
What about blue ball?
Sorry?
What about blue ball in just to start the season?
I think
it's
I'd give
really good in Sugarland.
I know. I don't know if I'd want to. Maybe this is like long-term team building thing, but I don't know if I necessarily want to start the clock on him before I'm necessarily. I'd give Wesneski the first chance, and then if he falters, then sure, go ahead and give blue ball
Of how you acquired him, I think. That he's probably going to get the first crack anyway, because you'd like to be able to say right from the jump, and you hope he has just an unbelievable spring, and you can say, hey, look, this was the guy that we had our eye on all along when we made the trade with the Cubs. This is a guy that we had ticketed for just this opportunity, and we feel good about it. That would be the ultimate if you're Dana Brown. But I don't know if he's any more than he's a guy. I mean,
no, I completely agree. It's not a good situation. I mean, and you could certainly argue that number five starter maybe is as big of a concern as the bullpen. Other than that, you're obviously going to rely on the number five guy, you know, a lot less. I'll have to look at see how the schedule lines up. You always have that, you know, especially early in the season, those stretches of schedule where you don't even need the number five guy right. because of days off. So hopefully that's the case here. Hopefully they can buy time for Luis Garcia and Lance McCullers. I don't even know what the optimistic timeline for those two guys would be. Maybe May. I'm purely guessing, but I think Wesneski probably gets the shot as the fifth guy. That could be really bad, but I don't see until those guys get healthy another option unless you want to pull up from AAA.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at the roster right now, and it's like the pitchers on their roster are Forrest Whitley, Hayden Wesneski, Fromber, Bennett Sousa, Taylor Scott, Caleb Ort, Fromber Valdez, Brown, Arrighetti.
I mean, maybe Wesneski is just the opener, and they kind of bullpen it on the fifth day. And you hope you get, you know, three innings out of Wesneski, but I don't know. I mean, I don't really know what the other option is right now.
If ever there was an opportunity, it's there for someone to step up. But I just think the injuries are going to pigeonhole you so badly, because even if you wanted Garcia, who was supposed to be ready at some point last season, to be ready now, he's not going to be ready.
He's just had multiple setbacks. It's hard to believe. I mean, one, you don't want to rush him, but two, it's hard to, like, feel confident. Maybe you'll get some answers once they actually get to spring training, but it's hard to feel confident that he's going to be ready at this point.
Yeah, my big thing, too, is like, is there something more medically to be concerned about than just, hey, when's he going to be ready? Because he should have been already.
No, I agree. I mean, you don't have setbacks for a positive reason, right? If there's setbacks, and there's been multiple at this point with Luis Garcia, it can't be good. I mean, we saw what happened last year where he was on the comeback trail, and it's like, oh, he's going to have a minor league rehab stint in Florida or whatever, and they had to shut him down. They got started again, and they had to shut him down again, all because he's still
That's
got pain.
That's why maybe it's having already been through the Lance McCullers saga. I have no faith or trust once a guy's been shut down more than once coming back in rehab that he's going to be healthy ever. Yeah, I mean, especially in this organization where they're probably never going to tell you the truth until he needs another surgery. That's deeply concerning to me. It's just that's one where I would have already believed that Garcia would have been back. He'd have been ready. He should be ready for spring training no matter what, because it's taken so long. To now, my first line of thought when you mentioned the name Luis Garcia isn't really good young arm that I – you know, good young starting pitcher that I can't wait to get back this season. Mine is, are we sure he's ever going to be healthy again before he needs something else?
Yeah, and it's another need, I think, that went underlooked at, under-addressed by the Astros this offseason, really under-talked about it by fans and media, including ourselves. But – Look, I get, and we heard Bagwell talk about this yesterday. Our pitching's great. Our pitching's great. Certainly, it is really good. It's certainly at the top, and I'd even say 1-4. It's very, very good. But, I mean, number five guy is a huge question mark. You hope Lance or Luis Garcia or eventually deep into the season Christian Javier takes that spot. But if they were willing to spend a little bit more, I think adding a fifth guy who can at least go out there and eat you 4 to 5 innings and not kill your bullpen every fifth day would have been a worthwhile addition to the roster.
That's why I know that right now they're saying that they're not going to go over the competitive balance tax. But at the same time, if you and we don't know what's going to happen with Alex Bregman, but assuming, let's just assume for a second, you're not going to bring back Alex Bregman. Is there a scenario where you can get two players? Excuse me. I would like to think that there's going to be a cheaper starting pitcher on the market, but I don't think you can stay under $10 million with an outfielder and still you can get a relief pitcher. You can't get a starter for anything less than $10 million all by himself.
You can get an outfielder and a relief for $10 million. I don't think, obviously, if you want to add that starting pitcher, and I have to look to see who's even available as a starting pitcher at this point. But there certainly would go over the competitive balance tax that they tried to add all three. And I don't think they will, because I think what we heard from Bagwell, you know, regardless of where you think his standing in the organization is at this current time, I think he knows something when he says our pitching's great. They're not thinking about adding a starting pitcher. They think they're fine. But, I mean, even if they had a fifth starter, I mean, how many years in a row do we have to go into the season thinking our pitching's great? And then, you know, 3 weeks into the season, 2 months into the season, half of it's fallen apart because of injury. Like, I don't know how many times we as Astros fans, not the fans, we're not making decisions, but how many times the Astros have to learn this from this mistake that you don't have enough pitching. If you have seven guys, three of them are going to be gone, you know, before you get to June. So I especially when you only have four guys and Ronel Blanco's been a journeyman until last year, I wish they would have added somebody to the rotation.
I think that's it. I think that if, you know, we've talked about on multiple occasions, if you're going to be out on Alex Bregman at $26 to $28 million plus a year, well, then I know that Jim Crane's a big splash guy, but why couldn't you at least kind of parlay some of that money into more than one player that could make you a better baseball team?
$26 million could have got you a fifth starter, a relief pitcher, and a decent bat that would have been better than starting, you know, Mauricio Dubon out there.
I don't know who the starting pitcher is, but you get Verdugo, you get a middle of the bullpen guy that we just got done talking about, a seventh inning type guy, and find me a starting pitcher that's just looking for an opportunity and wants to play with a winner or both. And I think that you're done. And, you know, later in the season, if you feel like, hey, this isn't going well or you spent too much money, then you can talk about if you have to try and pare some salary or get rid of somebody. But if this is truly a window open World Series chasing owner, I don't think it's far-fetched to ask that.
No, I that would have been my hope. But, you know, it's one of those things where I don't think Jim Crane – I don't know if it's – I don't want to say it's boring to him, but it doesn't feel like he gets all that excited about making the underrated moves that it takes to fill out the bottom part of the roster, if that makes sense. He obviously gets involved when it's time to bring back Justin Verlander. He gets involved when it's time to make the big splash for Josh Hader, but it feels like everything else is like, I don't want to go over the competitive balance tax for that.
Yeah, no doubt. And that's what kind of sucks. Like, if you're willing to do it in one direction for the big splashy star, why wouldn't you make the more kind of fiscally responsible deal that makes you a better ball club overall?
It's not fun. It's not sexy. That might be the
answer. Also might not be results driven, because how did Hader turn out last year? No, I know that everybody loves the back of the baseball card when it comes to Josh Hader. Cue soundbite here.
Sorry, I just moved it. I couldn't find it off the...
But at the same time, was Josh Hader the
Back of his baseball card.
There it is.
Yeah, well, thanks, Joe. Was Josh Hader the Josh Hader we expected when they made this deal and this big splash? Because to me, he was disappointing.
Yeah, see, I would agree with you, because when you look at basically everything but saves, he was disappointing, and he was disappointing in the postseason as well. But people will point to, like, after I think he blew this first save opportunity of the season last year, and after that he went on a 20-something save stretch where he converted every one of them. But saves, I don't know how you feel about this, but saves to me is one of the more overrated stats indeed. In baseball because it doesn't tell a story. I mean, if you come in facing 7-8-9 with a 3-run lead, okay, thank you for getting the quote-unquote save, but to me you didn't accomplish anything all that great. Like now, if you're coming and putting out a fire where you got a 1-run lead and 2-3-4s coming up with the runner on, that's something that is save-worthy and praiseworthy.
And also, the holds matter. Like, you come in a tie game in the Angels in the bottom of the ninth, and you give up a bomb that loses the game. That should matter. Like, you're supposed to be shut the door, lights out, ball game over when you face me. Now, you might have to hand the ball over in a tie game, but until you hand the ball over to somebody else, and look, kudos to him for doing what he has refused to do in the past and go, you know, back-to-back games, But at the same time, you've got to be able to close the door when you have the ball in your hand, especially at that rate of pay.
Yeah, and I mean, I felt good about him when he came in. I still feel good about Josh Hader now. But the version of Hader that we saw in San Diego where he was like sub-2 ERA, just completely untouchable, I don't think it's arguable that he wasn't that guy for the Astros last year.
All right, so with the starters that we mentioned, who are you feeling as your best fifth starter? And overall, how are you feeling like on a scale of 1 to 10 of where this pitching staff is? Where is this starting pitching? Where would you rate these starters as a rotation against the best starters in baseball? We know the Dodgers are on a different planet. They're in the National League. But rate the Astros starting pitching, because we've heard Jeff Bagwell talk about it over the weekend about how good our starting pitching is. Well, let's talk about it before we get out of here. We've got about a little less than 30 minutes to go on the show. Stay tuned for more. It's the Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 FM.
Houston's independent voice for sports, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Locked in with the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Hey, just kind of doing some housekeeping as we wrap things up around here. You have a new offensive line coach. If you are a Houston Texans fan, Greg Popovich is now out of his woes as his medical concerns with the Spurs. He will now be your offensive line coach as he stays in-house.
That would be a stunning move if Greg Popovich had been named offensive line coach.
What is Popovich's first name?
Cole.
Cole Popovich is your new offensive line coach. Do better than the last guy. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think, I don't know if this is Texans PR trying to get the good public word out there about Cole Popovich. In the reports that we've heard coming out, like, hey, he disagreed with Strausser, like he didn't like some of the things Bobby Sloag was doing. So this guy is smarter than the guys we let go, and maybe that is true. But there's something about promoting from within when your offensive line was one of the worst units in football.
I hope he's had a relationship with everybody coming in so that he's
good. That's the other thing. Like, is this a Nick Caley approved move?
If it's not,
I don't like it.
Like, I want Caley to be in full control of his offense.
Exactly.
So I want him to pick all of his coaches. I know Aaron Wilson had reported that a majority of the coaches that were on Bobby Slowick's staff would be back with the Houston Texans. There'd be a lot of guys coming back. I don't know how that affects Gerard Johnson. I personally would like Gerard Johnson back. I think that he is an up-and-coming name on the offensive side of the game in the NFL, and I think that him learning from this situation and what he learned from Bobby Sloat could be the best thing for him, whether it's here or somewhere else. So I would hope that there's a chance that some guys are coming back. I heard what you heard on Popovich. I hope to God that that's true. I hope that he comes in and learns from the things that didn't work last year, that he has his own ideas and thoughts, and that he can get the line together. But I think ultimately, offensive coordinator, if he's going to be in complete control of the offense, you got to have a relationship with the guy, and you got to believe that they're on the same page systematically.
Yeah, it's kind of like why I don't know. It just feels like whenever – and I feel the same way about whenever you replace, for the most part. I know, obviously, here in Houston it worked out with keeping Caserio and hiring DeMeco. But I, most of the time, like kind of clean sweeps when you're having a big change. Maybe – look, if Nick Haley, you know, looked at Cole Popovich and said, that's my guy, that's who I want, then fine. I'm completely fine with it. Maybe we'll get that answer if there's some sort of presser or actual, you know, press release from the team other than just seeing the news from Ian Rapoport. But I, on the surface, I don't like the idea if they just kept everyone that was here outside of a couple guys and is forcing Nick Haley to work with them. I, like you, would prefer Nick Haley to come in, you know, talk to the guys, basically have a kind of a re-interview process and have him decide who he wants and who he doesn't.
Well, let's also go back to the conversation that we started yesterday a little bit too, which is something that I've experienced firsthand. Allowing the general manager to pick the coaching staff is a disaster.
Yeah.
It is. It's a recipe for disaster.
And that might have been what happened here.
Yeah, and that I don't like. And I don't want that. And I don't want Nick Caserio to get involved or get overly involved in the picking of the offensive staff. Since you already have a relationship with Kaylee, you brought him in along with DeMeco. That means you should have a level of trust that if he is the guy that you wanted, that you believe in, then let him do his job. And to me, that's where his job is. Just like the team, and we talk about and we hear about all the time over on Kirby about the culture. Well, the coaches have a culture too, and part of it is a level of trust. And so if I am the new offensive coordinator and I'm calling plays for the very first time, I don't need someone that's been here that is might be a mole in the making that might be running to Nick and others in the front office without going through me first if I don't have a relationship with him. And I want guys that I personally pick that either I've worked with before, I totally respect, so that I know that I believe that our OC is comfortable knowing my O-line coach is a guy that I believe is going to get the job done, and this is why. As opposed to, I get this guy as part of getting the job, and one of the benefits of getting the job is I'm an OC for the first time, but one of the things that I have to deal with is the general manager's picking some of my staff. I would hate that.
Yeah, I would hate it. I mean, I hope it's not true, but I mean, especially since, I mean, and I don't know if we'll get the answer on this. We don't know. I mean, we hope it's DeMeco who picked Nick Haley as his offensive coordinator, but considering, you know, he and Caserio were friends in college, considering how long they worked together with the Patriots, on the surface, from the outside, without having inside sources, this looks and feels like Nick Caserio picking his offensive line coach, which I don't love to start. And if he's also on top of that telling his offensive line, or not, sorry, his offensive coordinator, if he's on top of that telling his offensive coordinator, okay, we're going to hire you, but you got to take this guy as your quarterback's coach, you got to take this guy as your offensive line coach, and, you know, they're on down throughout the rest of the coaching staff. I don't love it because I'd like Nick Haley. If you're hiring Nick Haley because he's a great offensive line, let Nick Haley decide who's going to help best put in his vision. And if he's being stuck with Bobby Slowick's guys, I think you're kind of tying his hands behind his back in a way.
And look, I've lived this in a different sport, but when Daryl Morey decided to hire Kevin McHale and then said to him, oh, by the way, one of the prerequisites to you taking this job is you get to bring one assistant coach of your choice in and the rest of the coaching staff I'm selecting. Like, that would have been a deal breaker for me because I know damn well that in meetings and in dealing with players, you can get an anarchy going real soon. You can get a mole.
They don't know who to answer to.
Yeah. Not only that, but you can have a mole that decides, hey, during our coaches meeting, Nick Caserio, this is what Nick said, and this is what he's talking about, and I don't agree with this, or this is that, or, and then you get other coaches that try to befriend, you know, build relationships with key players. Maybe it's CJ, maybe it's somebody else. And then suddenly it gets to the point where, hey, we don't agree with what Nick Haley is trying to do here. We think this. And then whether it's going up the food chain to Caserio or to DeMeco or going around the offensive coordinator, it just has too many pieces that can go wrong instead of continuity, which you have to have with an offensive staff.
Yeah, like I didn't feel like they needed to completely clean house of everybody. Like I think Gerard Johnson as a quarterback coach, if he wants to remain that, fine. And I thought, I mean, obviously the receivers dealt with a lot of injuries, but overall the receivers played well. So if you want to keep the wide receivers coach, fine. But certainly with at least the offensive line coach, since that was the biggest failure on the entire team, if you're bringing in Nick Haley, and the number one priority of not only for him, but the entire organization right now is fixing the offensive line And
not just personnel wise, but like continuity wise.
Yep. I mean, everything, you know, all of the above. If the number one goal is to fix that and Nick Haley's the guy to fix it, then he should have at least say on who his offensive line coach is. And maybe, look, again, this could be the case where they asked Nick Haley, hey, do you like Cole Popovich? And he said, yes. Then fine, wonderful, you know, forget this conversation. But it just has the appearance of, because of the timing, because he was already here, that you're kind of promoting a guy that he didn't have a say in.
Yeah, and this is where you get into that you want to avoid. If you're going to put a guy in control, then he's, you know, again, it's like the old Parcells line. If you're going to be responsible for serving dinner, then let me pick the groceries, sure, at least some of them. And when you don't do that, then I think that you're setting yourself for more problems than success. And that's why when you look at this, you want to believe that, hey, there's the, like you said, the offensive line is the biggest number one problem that we've all agreed, all three of us have agreed, has to be fixed this year. Nick, it's on Nick Caserio, it's on you from a personnel standpoint to determine who's coming back, who's not, what deals are out there, who you can bring in draft-wise and free agency-wise that make this offensive line better. But from an offensive coordinator standpoint, we expected, we didn't know if he actually could or couldn't or did or didn't, but we expect that part of the job of the offensive coordinator, aside from just calling plays, is you have to be able to fix the offensive line from a scheme standpoint and a continuity standpoint. You have to be able to be innovative enough, just like calling plays, to figure out, hey, if this scheme isn't working, then we can do something else and attack this a different way with the personnel we have, instead of immediately saying we got to rush out there and get somebody different. And that's where, if he's going to do that, then he has to have the total trust and belief in the guys that are working with him to help him get that done.
Yeah, because I want Nick Haley because I'm running Nick Haley stuff, because I'm running stuff from the Sean McVay tree. I don't want guys – look, again, Cole Popovich may be his own man. Maybe they truly believe what's been rumored, that he didn't agree with Slowik, he didn't agree – with their previous offensive line coach. And then maybe that makes this guy the right guy. But if he's kind of a Bobby Slowik guy, or a guy coming up from the system that just failed them, like, I'd rather Nick Haley bring in his own guy than rubber stamp this promotion.
Yeah, no, I think that's going to be really interesting to watch unfold, because of the fact that when you look at all the different possibilities and you look at all the ways that this could play out, you want this to be as seamless as possible in terms of making sure that the recipe is as set up for success as much as you can. And right now, we're already starting to question, is there a relationship? Is there going to be continuity? And that's not a good thing, not a good way to start the offseason. All right, we got one segment to go. It's the car wreck of the day. If you guys have nominations, get them to us, and let's get them in there as quickly as we can, because it's a short segment leading up to Soccer Matters. 713-780-3776. It's Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 FM.
ESPN 97.5.
You all right?
My leg is broken. The bone's coming through.
Give me your you prick. Where's my money?
This is the car wreck of the day.
Car wreck of the day. As always, I think we can be unified in this, BMAC, is the Twitch line. it is the cesspool of all crap that could be given during a three-hour time frame. But in the meantime, we can start with the fact that I'll start tonight, because there's one that was really irking me last night. It has nothing to do with the fact that it's a team that I follow on a pretty consistent basis. The Milwaukee Bucks last night took on the Oklahoma City Thunder. Okay, it's a big game. The Bucks trying to get right again. OKC, one of the best
teams
in the league.
Number one seed in the West, yeah.
But I really want to see that matchup, right?
Sure.
Whether it's on national TV or not, I want to see that game. I didn't have a chance to text one of my best friends, is the PR guy for the Bucks. I turn it on right before tip-off. No Giannis, no Middleton, no Dame, no Lopez, no way.
Like, it's split squad?
And it's on the road, where if you're OKC and you're playing a team from the other conference, you know it's the only time you get to see Giannis all year, and Doc Rivers decides, yeah, we're good here. We're not going to start anybody. And, of course, OKC gets up by 30 in the first half. They were up by as many as 40, I think, before they won by 20-some. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, look, I'm all for game or rest, like load management. I think teams should be able to handle their roster however they think gives them the best chance to win for the entire season. But sending the entire starting lineup feels like a step too far. So I'm with you in that it shouldn't have been the entire starting lineup. Maybe Adam Silver needs to look into putting some sort of guidelines in place. But, yeah, it's not a great look.
Yeah, I hate it.
Quickly, mine, yes. This is a visual. I sent it to you, yeah. And I retweeted if you want to go to @SackByBMAC. But from Albert Breer from the NFL Network or wherever, Super Bowl first, the media workroom is located in row D of the Superdome parking garage, and he's got a picture attached, and it's all these like all these black tablecloth tables, and the media workroom, you got probably over 100, you got over 100, maybe 200 people, and they put them in the damn garage.
That is ridiculous. That like, is the most ludicrous thing ever, and I know that Bourbon Street is close to the dome. But, like, there's got to be another answer.
There's
got to
be some sort of conference area or something.
Yes.
They put them in the parking garage.
That's inexcusable for an NFL decision. That's ridiculous.
I know I'm standing up to...
That wins by a landslide.
I know I'm standing up to people who demand free meals or maybe a little bit entitled at times, but my goodness, how do you put the media workroom in the damn parking garage?
That's a joke.
Yeah, it's a joke.
That's not...
So that's our winner?
You know it's not. That's our winner, no doubt about it. You know it's not a joke. Glenn Davis, Soccer Matters. He comes up next. I'm not kidding, y'all. If you love soccer at all, Glenn is the expert here, hands down, bar none. Thanks to Jeremy before he had to skip out. Thanks to BMAC. I'm Joel. We'll see you tomorrow. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5, 92.5 FM.